On this episode of This Week in Space, it's Space Potpourri. New headlines, eclipse wrap-ups, and more of our favorite space places. Stay with us.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is This Week in Space, episode number 106, recorded on April 12th, 2024. Yet more of our favorite space places and the big eclipse wrap-up. Hello and welcome to This Week in Space, the Space Potpourri edition, where we're covering it all. I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ast Magazine, and I'm here, as always, with the indescribable Tariq Malik, editor-in-chief of Space.com. Hello, partner.
Hello, Rod. Welcome back. Welcome back.
Well, from our same to you.
That's right.
And I'm going to whine about my travels when I get my first chance. But before we start, let us remind you to please not forget to do us a solid. Make sure to like, subscribe, and other podcast thumbs up goodies, because we need your love. We're counting on you. And now, drum roll, please. A space joke.
Woo! I'm ready for it.
Loyal listener Jan Wild, and I got eclipse jokes.
Oh, really? Wow. That?
Hey, Tariq.
Yes, Rod.
My friend Susie said, hey, I looked through a past.
What? That was great. No, wait. What is it?
Thanks for the spanking. My friend Susie said, hey, I looked through a pasta colander to check out the solar eclipse. Roy answered, oh, yeah? How'd it go? And Susie replied, I strained my eyes. Okay. Let's try another one. Hey, Tariq.
Yes, Rod.
A father and son are talking, and the son asks, Dad, can you explain what an eclipse is? And the father said, no, son. Get it? It's a spelling pun.
I love it. Wait, didn't we use that one last week for the actual eclipse? Oh, sorry.
Quiet. Nobody will remember.
Did you know that one of the most searched trending things after the eclipse was, why do my eyes hurt?
Anthony was saying that before the episode. And you know, sadly, I mean, you and I both warned everybody we could before the 2017 and certainly before this one. And yet still, and you know, I am assuming that that's accurate, that those people were really looking. And I had kind of a moment myself thinking about that. But hey, listeners, save us from yourselves. Send your best work or most indifferent space joke, because we love them all. As you can tell, we use them all at twist@twit.tv. And become famous, and you'll be on the air for our hundreds and hundreds of thousands of loyal listeners.
That's right. I heard that every listener represents 5 billion people, so that's great.
All right. So before we begin, so this week we're going to do expanded headlines, and we're going to do an eclipse wrap-up, and then with whatever time we have left, we're going to continue with part three of our favorite space places, because we never seem to get through these things. So that is where we are going. So, oh my God, the eclipse, Tariq says. tell me yeah. Everything.
Well, no. Well, when we last spoke, Rod, right? We were on the cusp of like an historic total solar eclipse, and we were gonna scatter to the wind to go to different parts of the country to see hopefully a celestial marvel that is the total solar eclipse. And so this is just kind of a quick roundup that it did in fact wow like millions of people across the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, including myself and my daughter and some friends of ours and the thousands of other people, hundreds of other people that were in Potsdam, New York for us.
And like, oh, your co-host.
And you, you know? And you too, Rod. Thank yes.
You.
Yes.
Thank you.
But you know, for just to remind people, I was in Potsdam, New York, a very small village in upstate New York. It's actually on the other side of the Adirondack Mountains. And it's a very beautiful place. And it was so much fun because even though we had some clouds, very, very light sheen, it kind of enhanced the whole experience because you could see the shadow of the moon coming. And then we saw the ring of, not the ring of fire, but we saw like the diamond ring and all of that fun stuff from there. In fact, I've got a little bit of a video, John and Anthony, what is this line 23? You can actually see what happened to us, where our little party was, because I didn't want to take pictures of the event because my camera's, you know, not the greatest, but I took a little video of the shadow washing over us, and it was a lot of fun. But we saw the whole thing. It was an exhausting day. We had a lot of tours at this college that we were at the State of University. Here it is. Yeah, so there's our little party on this hill. Zadie is clapping because it's starting. My daughter is the one in the middle there. And we had a nice time. It was like six hours to drive up to this place from New Jersey where we live. And we had a whole day's tours of what life in college is like for my daughter and her friend. And there it is, getting dark as the shadow of the moon passes all over us. And luckily their security lights did not turn on around the parking lot that's behind us. You can see it's getting really dark now as we enter totality. And it was absolutely spectacular. I mean, you had that 360 degree sunset all around us. And in fact, right now there's a guy behind us saying, "I can't see anything." And we're like shouting to him to take his glasses off.
Take off your glasses.
So that he can see it. So
did the, here's where my mind got stuck. Did the college tour, include like endless drinking training, or does that come later?
No. This was like, so this is SUNY Potsdam. It was a 2-hour tour and like an hour long orientation. Cool. About the school, kind of all of the different colleges that it includes, their goals, what life is like on the campus. You know, they spoke to other students as well. We saw a mock-up of a dorm room, and I'm not sure if I mentioned it last week, but Zadie and I did stay in the dorms as well.
That's so, always a thrill.
While we were here. So it was like a full immersive college experience, and I will hopefully have a story on it this weekend all about just kind of how it was a teachable experience in more ways than one.
Well, this reminds me of my trip up to see my son when he was going to Santa Clara University, which we all worked very hard to get him into. And as I walked up to the house he was living in, so this is Silicon Valley. So mm-hmm. It was a 900 square foot teardown that was leaning alarmingly to the left that they paid $6,500 a month for 900 square feet because of where it was.
Wow.
But the first view I had was three large trash bins filled with empty Keystone beer cans. If you ever taste the Keystone, I think they take the water straight out of a sewer pipe. So it was quite an alarming experience. Well, my eclipse experience was in Central Texas, just outside of Austin in a small town. We were staying in a Verbo. So I was with the International Association of Astronomical Artists, mm-hmm. which is a group of premier space illustrators, great people, about 25 of us. And Pat Rawlings, who, if you know anything about NASA art, is like one of the icons. He's one of the titans of the golden era of NASA art in the late 70s, 80s, and 90s. Just an incredible, incredibly gifted guy. So he put the whole thing together along with the president of that group named Aldo Spadoni. I know it's a funny name, so is mine. But he's a retired engineer who became a very gifted space artist. So it was cool being with those people because, of course, it's all visual and all very subjective and, you know, kind of these emotional reactions to everything. So he drove out to this ranch at an undisclosed location because it was owned by a very private billionaire. And we had about 350 acres of beautiful rolling land underneath a cloudy sky.
Oh, no.
So
but it's still that dark, right?
Well, we saw bits and pieces and so it had been cloudy off and on for 2 days. And we're all, you know, praying and clutching our pearls. And the initial phases we saw pretty well through cloud breaks. And then right as totality hit, wham, so did the big black cloud. Got like one little glimpse of what looked like an annular eclipse because through the clouds, you know, the corona ends up looking like the ring of fire because it's so filtered. What was weird though is I had eclipse glasses, I had two sets of eclipse binoculars I was passing around, and the problem was with the clouds, you put the eclipse glasses on, you can't see anything, you take them off and you just know you're roasting yourself because clouds don't really protect you, right?
Yeah.
So you're looking and looking away and looking and looking away and looking and looking away and seeing little purple things and thinking, oh God, tomorrow I'm going to be one of those statistics. But it was great. It got very cold. The wind started to rush in, of course, and we heard a little bit of animal activity, not too much. What we did hear, being Texas, was people firing off full clips in their handguns.
Oh, wow.
couple of miles away. Pow, 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 pow. It's like, I hope those bullets don't come down here at terminal velocity. So it was great. And then we got a tour the next day of Icon Technologies in Austin, which is a company that is kind of at the forefront of 3D printed structures in the U.S., homes mostly, and also they're working on lunar habitat. So that was a really, that kind of made up for it all.
That's great.
Oh, yeah. And the last night I was there, there was this massive electrical storm. First time I've ever seen lightning going sideways from cloud to cloud. Wow. So that was kind of my makeup for totality.
It was interesting because SUNY Potsdam, they pulled out all the stops. It's not a large school, but when they realized they were going to be in totality, they had like a viewing area where we were that had like a bandstand. They had music playing, live music playing and singing. And then around it, they had like a display of like turtles and a nocturnal gecko and these quail, and including what there's like quail that were in like an enclosed box where they didn't have any light and they're just kind of walking around through a webcam. And then we're going to see like what happens like during the eclipse. And they did, these quail went to like one little corner of their tank and piled up on each other and went to sleep. The nocturnal gecko woke up and started running around trying to find whatever it is that they eat. It was really strange. And Zadie got a really big kick out of seeing those animals and how they acted differently there too.
Did they have anywhere a pen of young children that didn't know what eclipse was? So you can watch that.
No, but I did see like some kids dressed up like as astronauts, and they gave away frisbees that had the eclipse on them, and they ran out of shirts. So I have to pre-order a SUNY Potsdam eclipse shirt because
You have a Star Trek chair. You don't need a shirt. So the only downside for me, besides the clouds, was trying to get out of there. Because mm-hmm. We'd all read the news stories, and I'm thinking, 2017 was no big deal. I got to the airport. It looked like the last plane out of Baghdad. I mean, wow. The line for baggage was about two blocks long out of the terminal. And I thought, oh, boy.
But did you leave the same day, like the evening of the eclipse?
No, I left on Wednesday.
Yeah. I mean, you had a couple extra days.
It was bizarre. But
we drove back the same night, but we decided not to go like right after the eclipse.
Right.
Because it's like
traffic was bad, too.
Watching a total solar eclipse with other people is like going to a USC football game, right? Is that like
or Woodstock?
Which is that right after like halfway before it's over, everyone leaves. And so right after totality, like everyone started to leave. And I had work to do for space.com, finalizing working with our team who were stretched out all the way across the country from you there, Rod, in Texas, all the way up through Canada.
Right.
And so we finished like around the 5:30, 6 o'clock timeframe and decided that we check out of our dorms. We went out for dinner at a really nice place, got denied for the second night in a row because we didn't have a reservation, but then we ended up kind of crashing their empty deck anyway. And it was a really wonderful evening. And then I think we hit the road very late at night and we still got waylaid by traffic. So the 6 hour trip to get home ended up taking another like about 8 hours, 9 hours, all the way. And we got home at 4:30 in the morning after leaving, I think at 8 o'clock at night. And, did I do the math there right? Yeah. about right. And it was absolutely, we were absolutely exhausted by the end of it. So I took a 2 hour nap, got up again for the next day, work day. So
are you done whining yet?
I'm not whining. I'm saying,
okay,
this is what it takes.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. Well, we have more eclipse coverage coming up right after this break. Don't go anywhere. All right. More eclipse stuff.
Yes.
So I want to read an email we got from Brandon Evans because I liked the way he characterized this. This is, I think, his first solar eclipse. And he said, this was a road to Damascus moment for me. What is a road to Damascus? I should know that probably.
Is that a movie? I don't know.
Sounds like Bob Hope.
I know movie, the Sword of Damocles. So
probably got,
maybe
got
it's more. Like a road trip, like a epic travel.
John, you're smart. You know what this is. What's a road to Damascus?
I'll look it up.
Okay. You look it up. he said it was a road to Damascus moment for me. And now I just want to, oops, hold on. I just want to spread the gospel of eclipses. That's another new one. I drove up to Cleveland to be in the path of totality. It's an 11-hour drive each way, 12 hours if you stop. But wow, it was completely worth it. I would have preferred a perfectly clear sky, but mostly sunny with light cirrus clouds isn't bad for Cleveland in April.
Grr. Road to Damascus is used in to reference an important moment of insight. So
that makes sense. Thank you.
Got it.
Thank you, Professor Wizard. The Great Lakes Science Center, right on the shore of Lake Erie, hosted an amazing Eclipse Fest with much support and participation by NASA, which was conspicuously absent where I was. They had rows of tents staffed by NASA employees eagerly telling the public all about previous and ongoing missions and so forth. And the eclipse experience in totality was one of the most profound experiences of my entire life. Got to agree with that. I think the only reason I didn't fall to my knees is because I was holding onto a tripod when it started. The sheer magnificence is awe-inspiring. There's a deep primal instinct in all humans that rebels against believing what you're seeing in that moment. Just like the animals, we feel the whole world shifting at night. But unlike the animals, we know that cannot be happening. I'm witnessing the impossible. The sun is gone, and the eerie beauty of the corona is enough that every single human being under the sky is struck with a sense of the incredible, which overwhelms rational thought. Then I spent the first 30 seconds of totality, we warned these guys, messing with my gear, wondering why I couldn't see the eclipse sun through the telescope I had attached my phone to. It was only later that I realized I'd forgotten to remove the solar filter.
Oh, no.
I deeply regret that I forgot to remove the filter, but I do not regret for 1 second my decision to stop fiddling with my equipment and just stand there and stare at a total eclipse.
Bingo. That's a great lesson. Yeah. So, you know,
just staring at it with my regular human eyes was one of the most powerful experiences of my entire life. I may have invoked some deities I don't even believe in. Sign Brandon Evans. So yeah, I got to agree with message, all that. Brandon.
Yeah. I bought a Celestron travel scope with an appropriate filter. I bought solar binoculars and all of that stuff. And the day before the eclipse, cause I had never used them before, we tested them all out. And we just decided, I mean, we observed the sun, we saw sunspots, we saw really great stuff, but we decided that we weren't going to have very much time, you know, to observe the eclipse through this stuff. So we'll go ahead and just skip it. So we didn't set any of that up so that we could make sure that we enjoyed it. And I'm so glad that we did, because this tour of the university that Zadie and her friend took was so long. It was 2 hours. It was to give you basically this entire introduction to the university, that by the time it was over, the eclipse was already underway. And then we're trying to make sure that the kids get something to eat for lunch, because it's like 2:30 now. And by the time I got all my gear from the press site to this place, it was 3:00, and now it's 20 minutes from the solar eclipse, the totality. Well, and so there wouldn't have been any time to do anything at all.
So here's the real point, you know, and this applies to eclipses, and it's certainly to rocket launches. First shuttle launch I saw, I had cameras and crummy cheap zoom lenses because I was young and poor and all this. And it's as if you weren't there, you know, you were watching it through the TV of your viewfinder. So for any of these things, it reminds, well, since you're telling long stories, I'll tell a short one. When I was 22, I traveled around the world. And one of my stops was India, and I went to the Taj Mahal, and I stood there and I thought in my young, inexperienced mind, okay, stand here and burn this into your head, because you're probably never going to be back. And this is one of the wonders of the world. And I still remember that moment very clearly. And admittedly, I don't remember a lot else about those years. So it works, you know, just experience these things. And speaking of amazing images, I want to add, John, this is on line 44. We have some images. While we were staring at broken clouds, other people were figuring out how they'd go into Photoshop and Midjourney and other places and make fake images of eclipses. And they are all over the place. I'm sure being at space.com, you've seen them all. Some were more absurd than others, but there's one that was credited to the James Webb Space Telescope that has a moon lit with Earth shine, with the corona around it, you know, an impossible exposure feat. And a weird, swirly, strange-looking corona that, if it was happening, would probably kill all life on Earth.
Oh, and my gosh.
That's one of them right there. Wow. So Snopes credited this to a mashup photo bash of an artist and some real images. So, yeah, there's a lot of fake stuff out there. And some of it's really convincing. It's all spectacular.
Yeah.
So no problem looking at it and saying, oh, that's really pretty. But most of them aren't real eclipse pictures. So,
And I had just kind of building on that. The night before the solar eclipse, so Sunday night, you know, on April 7th, my friend that we're on this road trip to see the eclipse with comes in like around 7 or 8 o'clock at night. I was covering a SpaceX rocket launch, and he's like, look at this. And it's a live video on TikTok, and it says live stream, it's the solar eclipse. And it's a live video, like it's running live from South America. Now, you and I both know, Rod, that the total solar eclipse was not visible from right. South America at all.
But it was for him because he ate mushrooms.
But it was for whoever this person was streaming it live. But it was enough that my friend saw it and he's like, what is happening? Is it really underway? You know, it's going to take that whole time.
Right.
And I'm like, no, that's fake. It's from, I think it was from 2019 when there was that solar eclipse over Chile and they had the live stream there. But there are folks out there now that are just trying to get away with all that stuff. And so, you know, kudos to everyone out there who was able to avoid all the fakeness and just enjoy one of the wonders of the natural world. You know, cleanly and without worry. In fact, in New Jersey, there was just an announcement that one of the libraries had to send out an alert on the day of the eclipse, like an hour or so before, to say that they're worried that the eclipse glasses they bought from Walmart were actually fake ones, right? Found out about it so late that they didn't know how to get the message out to everybody. So it's unfortunate that we have that kind of stuff going around, but yeah. Mark your calendars, you know, 2026 in Spain, the next big one, right? And
so I think that's a road trip for this podcast.
We should go. We should go. We could go to
the Alhambra and stand in the middle of the plaza.
And the dark sky sites out there, right? And I'm sure I pronounced that wrong. So
pretty sure you did too.
Oh man, yeah.
So, well, let me just. I have a sound effect for your friends that bought the fake glasses. You ready?
Yes.
My eyes. all right, stand by. So we completely inverted the show. We have headlines now coming up next, right after the short break. Stay with us. Headlines.
Yeah, I could talk about that in eclipse till the cows come home, but we should probably get to actual meat. So
ultimate SpaceX record attempt. So this is an ongoing set of broken records that I love.
Yeah.
How many times can you reuse a rocket? And let's just remind ourselves, up until the early 20 teens, nobody had ever reused a rocket before. Something you did. You flew them up, the booster fell into the ocean and broke up, and boom, there, Bob's your uncle, there's the rocket, goodbye. And Elon Musk said, I think you can reuse these things, and boy, can you ever, huh?
Yeah, so I guess was it 2015? Is that right? When they did the first one, or was
something
it
like that?
Yeah. Was it earlier than that?
Well, because it was after all those spectacular crashes and his blooper reel of exploding boosters.
Oh, that's right.
To come back, yeah.
So tonight, as we're recording this, it's April 12th. By the way, happy birthday, space shuttle program and human spaceflight. It's the anniversary of Yuri Gagarin's flight today. So that's what makes this milestone even more interesting, because today. SpaceX is going to launch another fleet of Starlink satellites from the Cape Canaveral Space Force Station, and they're going to launch it on a used, very used Falcon 9 first stage rocket. And so this would be, if successful, and it probably will be, the 20th flight of this Falcon booster. And that's a milestone, because I think originally when they rolled out this Block 5 variant of the Falcon 9 rocket, Elon said that they were targeting at least 10 flights of
them,
you know, and then that would be enough. But he did say,
he underspoke.
Yeah. Well, I will point out that I went back and I looked today, and he did say that as a stretch goal, he thinks that they could probably fly one 100 times, you know. So he kind of underscored it, and then he like really overinflated it. But 20 times is nothing to shake a stick at. You know, a lot of the space shuttles flew like what? Maybe 25 times, 26 times, you know.
With extensive refurbishing, though.
A lot of refurbishing, yeah. Just a massive amount. And so the fact that they've been able to get to 20 with this rocket in just a few years is amazing. Most likely, you probably have noticed that these really high flight number and high flight rate boosters, they're only using them for the Starlink missions, for their own SpaceX flights right now. The ones that fly for NASA or other customers, they have, you know, somewhere around single digits, you know, or so. That's getting up there as they get more dependable. But it's a really important milestone, I think, for rocket reuse, because I believe Elon Musk has shared that they've flown more missions with Dragon than space shuttle flights, if you count like all of the times that they've reflown things over and over again.
Or with the Falcon 9?
No, with...
Oh, with Dragon,
With including all the cargo flights and all the commercial flights and all of the crewed flights too. Like everything all together over and over again. And I think they only have like five Crew Dragons. And so there are four Crew Dragons. They're going to be building another one pretty soon.
And they only used to use capsules once too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing.
So it's just a big milestone. And the big question is, will they surpass that? And I was talking to my colleague, Robert Perlman, who wrote, he's covering the launch for us today. And he mentioned that he suspects that it might be another record too, because they just barely launched, from the same pad 2.5 days ago. This could be their fastest pad turnaround as well too. And that would be a key milestone, because they want to up the flight rate substantially. And SpaceX is outfitting this pad in Cape Canaveral for crewed flights too as well. So they want to make sure that they've got more options for their own crewed flights, so they don't have just the dependency on the Kennedy Space Center pad for those missions. So just keep an eye out. Launches at 9:22 p.m. Eastern time, I think, tonight. And SpaceX will broadcast that live on the X.com, their X account on Twitter, like all of their other missions. So.
And did you say this is a Starlink launch?
It is. Yes, it's a Starlink launch. So all the really high flight rate ones are Starlink, just because it's a little safer, I think, on the pocketbook if something goes wrong.
Yeah, right. That way. It's just his lost hardware. He can self-assure. That's all right. And yesterday we had another duck and cover moment.
That's
asteroid right. 24GJ2, as you put it, Dr. Clickbait, had a close shave with Earth, sort of. And it wasn't dangerous, but and it wasn't that big, right? It was the size of a minivan or something.
Yeah, it's like the size of a car. Yeah, but these types of asteroid flybys happen almost every day. My colleague Josh Dinner over at space.com grabbed this one, and basically this asteroid was discovered on, I think it was April 9th. So just a few days ago. And 2 days after that, it passed below a lot of the satellites that we depend on for like GPS right. and other types of things. Like
right
and
at the halfway point, right?
Exactly. It was about 11,600 miles.
Right. Geosynchronous is, I think, 25,000 or so.
Exactly. About 22,236. So it passed between all of that and it just zipped right on by, and there was no threat to our planet. But, it was about 16 feet long, you know, so it's like the size of a large car. And it would have burned up in Earth's atmosphere. Something that big usually just breaks apart unless it's made out of solid iron or something, which who knows? It could have been. It's just a reminder that, hey, there's stuff out there and it zooms by us all the time. And if anyone is ever interested in trying to find out, like, what's the next asteroid that we know of that's going to fly by Earth, NASA's Asteroid Watch. You just have to look that up, Asteroid Watch, NASA, and you'll find their little, next five flyby list. And it'll tell you, is it the size of a car? Is it the size of a house or a bus or maybe even like a stadium? It tells you all of that fun stuff, like right off the bat there.
And it's just one more reminder that planetary defense matters. And had this been the size of Montana instead, we certainly would have seen it earlier. But at this point, would have sat here goggle-eyed thinking, well, that's it. It's been nice knowing you. See you later.
I'm sure they would have launched some nukes at it. I'm sure.
If they're big enough, that's completely untested technology. And one close to our hearts. Is Voyager 1 back on track? So apparently what they've discovered, they pinged it and got enough of a data dump to figure out that it's part of the flight data subsystem. And let's bear in mind, this is what now, 47-year-old technology with a data recorder that is a reel-to-reel tape recorder. So it's like your old Commodore 16. So it's pretty ancient technology that packages the data for the actual scientific data for transmission. And I don't know if I guess it's software or at least a memory core in there was partially corrupted at about 3%, which is all it takes. And it, you know, they don't know whether it's just aged out and getting tired or if it was hit by some high energy particles, which can happen, especially galactic cosmic rays, are nasty that way. So trying to figure out a workaround. Voyager 1 is just over 15 billion miles away, as Carl would say, and the signal takes about 22.5 hours each way. So this is a slow diagnosis process.
Yeah.
And let's bear in mind, you know, the team, I'm sure they brought in other people, but the core team is 8 to 12 people working on a couple of Sun workstations. So, you know, it's you got to find people and understand the hardware, and it's ancient.
It is. And, you know, the investigative trail for this issue has been going on since like December, I think, when they first started getting the gibberish back from Voyager 1 that tipped them off that there was a glitch. And at the time, they did suspect that it was in this flight data system at that time, and they were just trying to find out where in the system that it is. And now, because they were able to kind of get this readout where they found out that it was corrupted by, you know, 3% of it was corrupted, that was preventing it from sending out, you know, all the data back, they think that there's just a single, I guess, computer chip inside the system that's, you know, that stores just part of this memory, this flight data system storage memory, that is causing all of this. And they don't know like why it's happening in that one chip that they've been able to isolate. It could have been hit by, you know, a cosmic ray, or just, you know, again, like you mentioned, the part could have just wore out after 46 years in deep space. But now they've got that in hand. And, you know, the folks at JPL, Rod, you worked with them. They dare mighty things, as we've talked to them before. They'll probably figure something out to continue getting usable stuff out of it. It just takes a lot of time. What is that? It's like 22 and a half hours one way. For light signals. So that's like you and I doing this podcast where I'll talk for a little bit and then I'll answer
you tomorrow, right?
You'll answer me tomorrow. Yeah.
And then it'll take another day to get there. And it's funny, you know, you mentioned a processor chip, if that's what it is. And probably, you know, this was launched in 78, 79,
77.
So that chip is basically a remnant of 60s technology, so it's probably the size of a deck of cards or a drink coaster.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because even though it was launched in 77, just like Tarek J. Malik, all the flight hardware that's certified for space use, it's always from like the decade prior, because that's what they've been able to prove works in space.
So. Although it's interesting, they have also found that larger processors, which is one of the reasons they still use the RAD 750 chips from the late 90s, on spacecraft, the larger chips with larger channels, you know, the wider conductors inside, are less susceptible to damage by cosmic rays as the new ones that are, you know, 5 nanometers or 3 nanometers to just get the hell kicked out of them by cosmic rays. All right. So we got another set of headlines coming from you on, hold on, Space Symposium. And we'll do that right after this break. Stay tuned. You have guys on the ground people on the ground at Space Symposium. Tell me everything.
Yeah. So
first, tell me what it is.
Yeah. So this, as if the total solar eclipse on April 8th wasn't enough, that was also the kickoff for the Space Symposium in Colorado Springs, in Colorado, which is, you know, what do they call? They call the reporters, like, annual gala for the president's talk, like the prom for journalists. This was like the big prom for space industry, right? Where everyone flocks in there for this like week long conference hosted by the Space Foundation. And they discuss everything from what new contracts they want to announce, what new spacecraft they want to build. There was a company that announced new inflatable habitats. Vast announced that it's going to use Starlink for internet connectivity on its private space stations. The Space Force talked a lot about conflict in space all at this conference there this week. I kind of just had like a shotgun approach of just like some of like the key headlines that I had seen that came out of there for this roundup, mostly from Space News and space.com, starting with Space News at line 29 there. NASA's Deputy Administrator Pat Milroy, who you all remember joined us not once but twice on the podcast, gave a big presentation on the first main day of the conference to talk about NASA's new sustainable space flight or space exploration plan. And this is just a new kind of comprehensive plan that the agency has put together, really to have a sustainable strategy for space exploration, where you're kind of launching missions on plans that will be like sustainable over time, also sustainable in terms of like the types of resources they use, so that you're not, you know, leaving a bunch of junk up there in space, that you're using, that you're disposing of stuff properly after you're done with it in orbit, and that you're not just messing up the universe for everyone else to come later. I think it's really interesting. We haven't, you know, space.com hasn't had a lot of time to report all this. Again, we're a little distracted with the solar eclipse, but Space News is, Jeff Fallon has a really good play, a piece where he talks about how this new plan, and it's the first volume of what is expected to be like a wider integrated space sustainability strategy, sets kind of six key goals to kind of sustain the agency over time, to make sure that whatever they do now is going to not make, you know, space exploration that much harder, because they were either wasteful, or they're kind of cluttering up the moon, right, for what they want to do, or they're messing up some of the legal issues for stuff. So it was a very interesting time to see that as they're getting ready to return to the moon, that they want to set these frameworks up so they've got an infrastructure to build on the future of space exploration. Now, you would think that they would build all of that in hand, but it seems like a much more far looking approach for space exploration.
And close to my heart, one of my favorites, next topic, China threat.
Well, this was actually not the only time China was mentioned during the space conference, but there were several discussions by Space Force officials that singled out China's work as kind of a major impetus for what the U.S. needs to do in space defense-wise. General Stephen Whiting at Space Command gave one of the main talks on Tuesday that was really saying that China is moving at breathtaking speed, both in its space technology with what they're doing. They've got quantum satellites now and whatnot in orbit, as well as the development of new launch vehicles, new types of satellites, and plans for in-orbit intelligence, which, of course, being the Space Force, they're a lot more worried about. And so, you know, they've got, he actually said that China has built a kill web over the Pacific Ocean to find, fix, track, and target U.S. And other allies' military capabilities from space, which sounds really, really scary. So
when you say over the Pacific, you mean geostationary orbits or ground-based?
No, they're saying it's a web of, so basically, like, the whole Pacific Ocean, they're watching and tracking everything that
from US orbit is
doing. From orbit, yes, from space. And probably in space as well. That's another concern that the Space Force mentioned at this conference, not from General Whiting, but from General Saltzman a day later, about how they need to be much more mobile, much more flexible in the right types of systems that the Space Force needs, things like in-orbit refueling, in-orbit repairs, etc., to basically prepare for what else might happen in orbit from other foreign nations like China or Russia or whatnot, who are getting a little bit more bolder with on-orbit actions. China, for example, recently tested like satellite collisions in space, like bumping satellites and whatnot, where they bumped an old satellite around and they have their own reusable space plane, which they've launched a couple times, like the X-37B that the Space Force has. We're not sure like what that's done, but we know that it's deployed some stuff in space, just like the U.S. version can do. And they're still researching all of that stuff to see like what are the limits of those capabilities, what new capabilities are being developed right now, and what else could be coming down the pipeline.
They've also done some stealthy station keeping up there, as I recall.
Yeah, yeah, with the Shenlong space plane, as well as with other satellites. They've done rendezvous operations where they've taken up partner satellites and just flown them around each other a bit. And you know what we've seen too is they've recently launched kind of stealthy missions to the moon. It failed. They launched like two satellites that were going to fly around the moon, getting ready for their next big mission. But they didn't announce that they were going to launch the moon mission, and the satellites end up, getting destroyed because they didn't reach the right orbits because of their launch vehicle. But they're getting a lot. The country is getting a lot more. I don't want to say aggressive, but bolder in its launch pace, its types of missions, and the involvement of the military in a lot of these things. It's also why the military had a special panel at Space Symposium specifically called Deterring Conflict in Space. And I have not seen a panel with such a direct name at this symposium in a long time. It was a very hot topic this week there, according to our writers, Mike Wall and Brett Tingley, who we've had on the show as well before, and we're covering it for us there.
This might make an interesting episode at some point if we could get somebody in who really knows. You know, I have a vague idea. Of course, we know what NASA's budget is, and we have an idea that the Chinese spaceflight budget in general is about half, although it's increasing every year. But what we don't know in the U.S. side is what the black budget is. Mm-hmm. For Space Force and others. And I don't know if China even has one or if it's all grouped in one kettle there. And yeah, if we even have a decent idea of what either one is.
The challenge there is that, you know, it's easier in the U.S. to parse out like budget schemas because you have like there's the NASA budget. It's a civilian program. There's the Air Force budget. There's the Space Force budget that are listed publicly. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that there could be all these other classified projects that are funded and we don't get to see them somewhere else. In China, the space program is very, very much tied into the military as a program. So the right, funding there, right. The funding apparatus is much different because it's just kind of all under one.
It's murky. Exactly. Yeah, and even a lot of the private space efforts have strong ties with the military, so exactly. It's really possible exactly. to parse that stuff out. Well, this will be a developing story. All right.
It will. You know, we should ask Leonard, because Leonard also was at symposium this week, getting the latest on the U.S. Space Force's interest in cislunar space, and I'm really excited to hear what else is going on there.
And hey, Monday, there's a NASA teleconference on Mars sample return. That'll be interesting.
Yeah. For sure.
I'll be there. Sierra Space Ultimate Dropship Cargo from Space. What the heck is that?
Yeah, this is a really, really, really fun one. We've been talking a lot about ways to get into space. And, Sierra Space wants to figure out ways to deliver stuff from orbit anywhere on the planet within 90 minutes. And they call it, and I kid you not, their Space Ghost, which I love. You have to love that they're calling it Space Ghost.
I saw the first Space Ghost series.
So did I with the monkey and the kids. Man, that would drive me crazy.
Zorak, yeah.
Zorak, yeah. You've got your own Zorak in the background there. But basically, it's a new concept for on-demand cargo delivery from Earth orbit that they want to be able to land supplies anywhere that they're needed. And you can imagine the capabilities and the interest that the U.S. government might have in this kind of thing. The government and the Space Force is already very interested in on-demand, point-to-point cargo delivery using rockets. SpaceX's Starship is a very front-running candidate for that kind of system if they can get it up and running in time. And so this type of concept dovetails very nicely on the Sierra Space side with the fact that they are planning to build their own private space station too, which you would need a capability of sending stuff back to Earth, like experiments, like other hardware, things that you would need to have a private space station viable. And so this would kind of parlay that requirement with a kind of service for folks that might want cargo delivered wherever they want. So if you can imagine a company that flies an experiment to a Sierra space station, but doesn't want to go all the way to the U.S. or whatever to pick it up, they could drop it off there, right? If they wanted that service, and it would land, somewhere near there. And this Space Ghost thing, this platform, I keep saying Space Ghost, but it's just called the Ghost. it would basically kind of have a heat shield to slow itself down, and then and brakes, and then it would parachute down if they would be able to catch it either through the air or just on land and go retrieve it, pull it out. It looks like it can handle right now in the designs that I've seen like a large kind of CubeSat type thing. It would have a deorbit motor that would slow the satellite down a bit, and then they would be able to pick it up from its heat shield. It's like a umbrella that opens up the heat shield itself to protect the satellite on the way down, and then they would be able to pick it up on the ground. It would have a steerable rudder that would guide its kind of parafoil descent system within about 300 feet of a target. And so you would just have to get within a football field's length of wherever you want it to get, and then just go pick your stuff up from space. And you could see that being useful if they want to drop, survival kits or inflatable boats or rations or even weapons, right, for the military, to different targets around the world, or if it's like a humanitarian thing and the costs are low enough, they could drop aid, that kind of thing, very, very quickly to a certain, you know, pinpointed spot on the earth. I could see that being very interested for like humanitarian causes in very remote places. So
you bet, a whole payload of Planters cheese balls. All right. I'm putting you on the flash round 120-second timer for the last one, Star Trek versus Star Wars. Gotta love this.
This is hilarious because Jeff Faust at Space News hosted a who is best at symposium at the Redwire booth there. And it was basically these space people going at it about which franchise is the best franchise on the planet. Now, you know me, I have the Star Trek chair. I don't have the Star Wars chair. So I have made my choice. But if you are very interested to find out, and this is the only reason I bring it up here, is that if you're interested to find out who wins on the space wonk battlefield that these people are. I mean, Jim Bridenstine, former NASA administrator, is there. I would assume that he's a Star Wars person, probably, but I could be wrong. I could be wrong. You had people from iSpace. You had people from NASA's chief technologist was there. Mike Gold was there from Redwire. So, you know, they were all going like head to head with Team Star Wars and Team Star Trek. So it was very interesting to kind of see, you know, how that all panned out. That's what happens at symposium.
You know, as an author, I have an allergy to plagiarizing, but the International Space Development Conference is coming up in May, which you will not be attending in Los Angeles. And that's the National Space Society's big annual event. And I have a Space 2.0 panel on Sunday morning in the plenary slot, but I have to say, that's a pretty appealing idea, especially when you these big brains up there saying, okay, I know you run NASA, but tell me what you're like. And the way to phrase that actually is, which one is stupider, Star Wars or Star Trek? Because that gets the food flying right away.
I think though that that's like a debate that you could have every year as more and more of each franchise comes out with the books and the TV shows and the films, right? So I don't think it's a one-off. I think that you could just bring it back every year and just keep seeing who wins. You know, there's at least two more Star Trek TV show, Star Wars TV shows, and one more Star Trek TV show or film slated to come out in the next year. So, you know, today, this year's debate may be obsolete by next year.
When you make it to an ISDC, we'll co-host that one. How's that? All right. Stand by. We'll be right back. Hey, TikTok, let's talk about our remaining favorite space places. So I have to apologize because I thought I had gone back and ticked off the ones we already did. If I start repeating myself like a blithering old fool, Tarek, please, you know, give me a virtual slap and tell me to move on.
Yeah,
I don't believe I talked about Vandenberg Space Force Base before, did I?
No, we didn't. And I've actually never been there. Have you? Have you been to
Vandenberg? Oh, yeah, a bunch of times. So Central California coast. Just seaward of Lompoc. Don't call it Lompoc. They get very upset. Or is it the other way around? I think it's Lompoc. Small town. And then Vandenberg takes a big chunk of coast. And like a lot of military installations, it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of acres of rolling hills. Beautiful place right on the sea. And, you know, this and Camp Pendleton in Southern California are two of the last parts of the California coast that are truly untrammeled because the military has it and, you know, they use it in a fairly respectful way. So Vandenberg has a number of launch sites. You can get tours if you work hard enough, but if you're there to see a launch, you can really just drive down any road on the perimeter of the base, find a place to pull off, set up shop, and you'll see it a pretty good view. Last time I was there, it was for you, I believe. I was recording an early Falcon launch. And I think I told you the story, but we're up on this windswept bluff, which wasn't even a viewing site. It was just, you know, chopped off top of a hill, a bunch of journalists up there with dust and grit being blown on our faces. And it was freezing cold and all that. And we got no audio or anything from launch control. So finally, we're getting to the final moments and this beat up old van pulls up and a couple of guys get out and start spooling cable and setting up a couple of ancient speakers that probably had tube amps in them. And we finally are hearing not the countdown, but some back channel of, you know, valve maintenance or something. So we still didn't know when it was going to launch.
Like the mission audio, you mean? Or
it was mission audio, like a lower level tech channel. So it didn't have the, you know, all right, we're T-5 or any of that. It was just like, Valve 17B appears to be there it goes. It's better. So we're listening on that. So this young, I think she was a corporal, shows up, and she's from the public information office, and she's giving interviews. So I set her up to do an interview for you and Dave Brody faithfully. And I'm recording, and suddenly I hear this gasp, and I look up, and the rocket's like already 10 degrees up in the sky.
No.
I got to swing the camera off. It was kind of a comic moment and catch what remained of the launch. But anyway, there's a number of great viewing sites. And of course, like anything else, you go on the internet and type in Vandenberg Space Force Base rocket launch viewing, and you'll find a bunch of things. What I have not tried, so there is no coastal road on the seaside of Vandenberg. It's all inland. But if you take the train, Amtrak up there, there is a station right at Vandenberg.
Huh.
It would make an incredible viewing site. I don't know if they close it during launches or not, but if you could get there, of course, making sure that you knew a train was coming to take you back, that would be sensational.
Now, forgive me if you mentioned earlier, again, like I said, I've never actually been there. If I live like in Los Angeles and I'm going to drive, how long of a drive is it to launch?
About 3.5 hours.
So 3.5 hours. So
yeah,
you're talking about a pretty good, like you can't just pop in, like if you lived in Orlando, to go see a launch and then come back again.
But it's easier than getting to Florida. For those of us on the West Coast, this is all we've got. On the East Coast, you're spoiled for choice because you got Kennedy and Wallops and Canaveral and everything else. Lucky devils.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you. You know, come on out here, Rod. We'll go see a launch. So
speaking of the East Coast, what have you got?
Well, you know, I did we talk about Wallops? I don't remember if we talked about
Wallops. I don't think we did.
Yeah. So I think
would we, frankly?
I will educate you, Rod.
Please.
Because as we were just talking, you're talking about Vandenberg, 3.5 hours to get to. And then, you know, you're out there kind of in a really isolated place, and that's all you get. You're going out there to see the launch or lack of launch, because Mike Wall, who's been on this, you know, from space.com, went out there to see, I think, Parker Solar Probe launch, and it was so foggy they saw absolutely nothing, and it was a nighttime launch. You know, they didn't even see the plume. We were webcasting it live, and it was a black screen. You know, in front, we actually turned off our webcast because you couldn't see anything.
Welcome to the dark.
I tell you, but Wallops, NASA's Wallops flight facility is based on Wallops Island, Virginia, and I can't believe I didn't mention this last time, but this is one of my favorite places to see a launch, largely because the activity has only recently, like in the last 10 years, started to pick up. Where I live in northern New Jersey, it's about a 5-hour drive down there, and the drive isn't too bad. It's just most of it is in New Jersey, which, you know, that is, you say, you know, take that or leave it. But one of the interesting things is that, first of all, it's not like Kennedy Space Center where you have to buy tickets at the visitor center to go see it. It is first come, first serve until they fill up the rather limited parking area that they have, and then they close the gates so that you can't do it. But there is ample viewing on the coast around the Wallops flight facility. It's a couple hours. Actually, I think it's about 3 or 4 hours outside of DC, if memory serves. I've never driven that way before. I've only driven down from New Jersey. But there's a lot of other things around it. It's very close to Chincoteague Island in Virginia, which is where they run these wild horses every summer. And seaside
community. What's that name again?
Chincoteague Island. And there's a national seashore there on their nearby Assateague Island. So they got the Teague thing going on there. There's a national seashore park, you know, that's overseen by the National Park Service. So, and those are open fairly year round. So basically whenever you go down there, I say basically a lot, I just noticed that. But whenever you go down there, if the launch happens to not go get off the ground or it's delayed for a day, there's other stuff to do, and you're not really far from like a lot of other amenities, some other towns around Maryland, around Virginia. They're all kind of fairly close together, and you've got this kind of seaside feel. There's a local ice creamery that makes rocket fuel ice cream. There's cayenne pepper in it. I highly recommend.
Wow.
It's quite good. Yeah. and so the Wallops, I mean, the reason I bring up Wallops is because while it is this smaller launch site, and it's not They don't launch from there a lot. Rocket Lab has started launching from there. And as you know, Rocket Lab is launching a lot of Electron rockets. They're building a new one to launch out of Wallops, specifically called the Neutron rocket. It's like a Falcon 9 type rocket. And so the pace has been picking up. Northrop Grumman had been launching their Cygnus vehicles on Antares rockets out of this flight until they finished the last one. And when they get the new version of the Antares rocket, they're going to launch out of there as well. And
that was curtailed because the end of life, well, the end of use of the Russian rocket engine.
The end of use of the Ukrainian first stage. Yeah. So they had to weed that one out, and they're building a new kind of whole cloth, Northrop Grumman type vehicle there, with, you know, newly sourced engines, et cetera, for the future, for the new vehicle. And so they'll resume flights there eventually, for that, provided they get another use case beyond Cygnus for it. Although I suspect that Cygnus, could be a good candidate for other cargo, trips for NASA, for private space stations by the time the new rocket comes online. But I've been advocating, particularly to people that are in like the mid-Atlantic area, to New England area, if you are willing to drive, you know, like half a day, 5 hours, and you don't want to invest, you know, the thousands of dollars you would in a plane ticket to go to Florida or California, you know, and deal with the hotels that ensues, then this might be the spaceport for you. It's got a small museum, but it's a nice museum of different things to see. They have a lot of interactive exhibits there. They do have a gift shop, which I think everyone should check, you know, if they're going to go to a spaceport, where you can buy a lot of knickknacks and whatnot. They used to sell moon pies because they launched the Laddie moon mission out of there. and that was a special commemorative moon pies there. And the viewing, you know, you're not too far away. You're about 3 miles away from the launch pad, and they have, you know, stands and whatnot, and a little, you know, pop-up snack bar that comes in during the time frame. They have winnowed down the crowds, though, so you do have to get there early if you want to get in to see it, because when they Northrop Grumman launched several missions at night, in the winter, in the fall, and on weekends, and it was really hard for people to get to. And when they launched their first daytime mission during spring break, they had 4,000 people show up, and it overwhelmed the streets in capacity. It got a bit dangerous. And so they no longer allow side of the street parking in front of the building anymore. So you have to, the museum, you have to actually park there, or you're end up picking up a different seaside somewhere else. So, but there's lots of parks that you can check out.
So because my delightful partner likes to indulge himself in his stories, we're coming up close to the hour, but I've made an executive decision only after consulting with our masters, however, that we're going to run a little long. And my next pick, weird as it is the Shanghai Science and Technology Museum. Mm-hmm. So a big grand place, looks like the UN from the front. It's got, you know, flags all over the place, this big curving building, pretty modern. It's interesting because you're seeing, of course, everything from a Chinese perspective. There are limited views or limited English panels on things. So there's a big, long Chinese explanation and then like half a sentence in English. Rocket. This is a rocket. My two favorite parts were they had a Shenzhou display. So it's a full-sized Chinese modified Soyuz, extensively modified, in display and cool lighting. You know, it's got the kind of moody lighting and everything, but you can really see close up both how spectacular the technology is and how old that technology is, because the cables are all an inch fat and all the components are big and kind of bolted on. And you can see places where the Russians were probably installing things with sledgehammers. but it's pretty spectacular. And then there's another room that has rocket models. This was very, very much a China thing. You go in, and so here's the Long March 3, here's the Long March 5, here's the proposed Long March 10, and here's the Saturn 5. And they're all the same size, right? So the mid-sized, lightweight Long March is exactly the same height as the Saturn 5, and I'm standing there thinking, you sneaky devils. but, you know, if you don't know better, then you just assume that's the case. They also had a small, not terribly detailed model of the Tiangong Modular Space Station, the final iteration they have up now, version 3. And what else? Oh, spacesuits and then a number of other displays that were not very well detailed. So I wasn't exactly sure what I was looking at. But if you're in Shanghai for other things, there's plenty to do in that city. It's a 21st century wonderland. It's a worthwhile stop to see just because now you're seeing the space endeavors of Russia and the United States and China through their lens. And it's a little tilted, you know, it's your head's a little sideways in terms of Chinese achievements, but, and this was probably five years ago. So a number of the robotic probes had not yet been detailed there, but it's an impressive program. It's moving fast. It's something we're keeping an eye on in this country. And, you know, hopefully ultimately someday, please, if we could start working together instead of being angry at each other, we could do amazing things. And I don't know how likely that is. There's a lot of challenges there, including U.S. laws, but, you know, if it could be made to work, that would be spectacular.
Wow. Do we have time for one more? That's very, very well said, Rod.
We have time for as many as you want, brother, because you know what? Our audience can always hit the stop button if they want. So, I have permission from the backroom gang to continue a bit longer.
Okay. Well, you just reminded me, I should put Estech on this list from ESA because that's outside of Amsterdam. I'll do that for next time. Not for today though.
Okay.
Since it is important to not be so US centric, with our choices, but I know that we are limited with the ones that we've been to, over time. But I guess the last one I wanted to bring up was the Marshall Space Flight Center. And U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Mm-hmm. I think this is on your list that you had put up here, too. But the reason I wanted to kind of claim this one on line 48, John and Anthony, is because that's the home of U.S. Space Camp. And it is a formative place for young Tariq J. Malik when I was in high school and going to space camp for the first time, meeting friends that I would end up keeping for a lifetime. And of course, beginning a relationship with NASA that continues to this day. but Marshall is like a really important place. I mean, it was where Von Braun and his team hold up to start developing the spacecraft and engines that we would use to get Americans into space. There's a whole museum there, the Space and Rocket Center, that chronicles that whole thing. There's like a hanging Saturn V rocket inside this massive facility that I wish I could find the pictures for it so that I could share them, because there's me in a space camp flight suit, you know, standing all heroic.
I don't want to see that
with the engines of the Saturn V behind me. And so I think the last time I was there was back in 2014 or so. And so it's a lot of things that are there have changed because, you know, a lot of the simulators that they had built at that time for the asteroid rendezvous mission are now changed for Artemis and whatnot for the kids at space camp. But you can go on a tour of the area and see like the actual mission control that they have there for the cargo stuff, the logistics that NASA runs for the International Space Station. You can kind of see where their mission control is for all of that stuff that they oversee there. They have a tank, you know, for spacewalk prep and whatnot there, largely
water tank,
used,
you mean, right?
Water tank. Yeah. A water tank used, by folks for some simulations and whatnot. I've been in that tank. It turns out I can't scuba dive, to save my life, which would be bad if I was an astronaut, I think. And then of course, they have a lot of stuff geared for education to inspire the next generation of kids. There was at one point, a large Skylab, section there. It was outside, and you could go check it out, but it got kind of rotted out and whatnot, and they had to salvage it. I think there was another Saturn V like exterior life size outside as well that they had to go save and salvage too. It's a really interesting place. Now you do fly into Huntsville, so you have to get there. So it is a trip, to plan. And, for space camp, if our readers or listeners are interested in that, you do have to book that trip way, way early. They do sell out over the summer. And that is something that we've had a lot of trouble with because my daughter would like to go. My nephew would like to go together. But every time, like the weeks are always kind of really packed out very far in advance. And Space Camp itself had a bunch of challenges, specifically during COVID. They were running out of of cash. And I believe Boeing stepped in to give them the money that they would need to keep funding to get through that whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I was glad to see that they've come through it relatively great. But they hosted the Guinness World Record of rocket launches for the Apollo mission, where they launched hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these rockets together. So, I mean, it's a very interesting place filled with history. And Space Camp, when I went there, was taught by original engineers from Von Braun's team. I don't think it is anymore, because I think sadly a lot of those folks have passed on. But it is a good place where you can see both what the future might hold for this new generation and a lot of the history, because that's where a lot of the original rockets, both for the military and then for the space program, were developed.
So I have a short story, which I'm sure I've already shared, but it bears repeating, of my time at Space Camp. The last time I was at Huntsville, or as they used to call it, Hunsville, in 1984.
84?
Tarek, yes.
Wow. Just a twinkle. I was seven. So.
Yes, and you weren't there. So our class on rocket propulsion was taught by Konrad Denenberg, who was a contemporary of von Braun's, a very, you know, major important figure in the trade. And so he sat down, a really nice guy, you know, and he sat down and gave us this very patient, and us being the first group of journalists to go through. So We were sleeping in the little triple high stacked wooden bunks that the kids slept in and all that. It was pretty basic at the time. And the simulators were like, you know, Atari 2600 level, but it was still cool. So Conrad's giving us this talk. And then at the end, he says, if you would like to meet up with me later, I will be at Old Heidelberg. Happy to see you there. So a bunch of us made our way to Old Heidelberg, which is this, you know, German beer hall down the road. And we walk in and we're looking around and, you know, they're all the waitresses with those low cut frilly blouses holding six steins in each hand, walking around smiling and stuff. I mean, it was like stepping into Berlin in 1939, right? So I finally spot Conrad at this table with a bunch of other older guys. And I walk over and I'm just about to tap him on the shoulder. And I heard him saying, and you know, we almost had some in 1944. It was a very close to, oh, hello.
Oh my God.
I thought, ooh, they're replaying the simulation. All right. I have two more. What?
Oh, there was something about it, I wanted to say something about Space Camp now. And I had it. And then now it's gone.
Oh, this is a sign of old age. All right. Well, if it comes back, let me know. Biosphere 2. Which is outside of Tucson, Arizona, was an experiment back in the 80s. 80s, right?
Yeah. Jane Pointer, right?
Huge, yes, this huge structure built by a billionaire. And what most people have heard of it, that it was this closed environment, closed system filled with plants and animals. And you can go visit this. It is immense. It is immense. It's all glass to let the sun shine in. And it's filled with, I mean, not just plants and trees and stuff, but they've got a tropical biome and a Pacific biome and a rainforest biome and all this. And it's just the most amazing place. And the idea was to host these multi-year experiments in closed loop systems, which, although it's not always mentioned in the same description, a lot of it was towards off-world settlements, where you've got to have a closed environment like this if you're going to survive. So you have to make decisions about what plants, what flowering plants, what fruits and vegetables you're going to grow, what insects you have to include, what, you know, certain number of stock animals, and of course, accommodating the people and keeping the atmosphere balanced. So in the first run, which I think lasted, 8 months maybe, they had 8 people in there. And the interpersonal drama started pretty quickly, which is another good warning about off-world habitations. You have to be careful in your selections. They got to the point where the two groups were divided. Two subgroups were divided, not talking to each other and like staying in separate ends of the thing and all that. But they also had problems with oxygen depletion, and the carbon dioxide was getting very high. And they finally had to make an executive decision to pump oxygen in there. And one of the large reasons, it turns out, was that the concrete, as it was curing out, I mean, it was hardened, but, you know, concrete cures over a very long period of time, was leaching oxygen out of the atmosphere.
Oh, wow.
So lesson learned, right? Yeah. They also had massive problems with ants growing out of control. And it's built on the desert floor, so that's going to be a problem. But, yeah, it's just amazing you know, for years that space settlement advocates have talked about, well, you just build this huge cylinder in space and you put dirt in there and grow plants and put people. I'm simplifying a lot, but the idea was, how big a challenge is it to create a small self-contained biome that is a doppelganger for Earth? And as it turns out, there's a lot of variables in there.
Yeah.
When you get the tour of the place, on either end, they have these big cylindrical buildings called the lungs. So the building, the main enclosure is so large, they needed to have these huge rooms. They're probably 70 feet across with this enormous rubber diaphragm with a weight in the middle of it. Is it rubber or metal? Anyway, that would rise and fall to equalize the air pressure as the as the air inside heated up and cooled down. I mean, it's just an astonishing, really over-the-top technological experience to see this thing. And it's generally regarded as a failure, but as so often happens with technological exercises like this, the failure of certain parts of it were where the learning was. When you succeed easily, you don't learn much except, oh, we made some good decisions. But when things fail in incremental ways or struggle in incremental ways is where you start learning, okay, this is the next challenge we have to address. You know, how many ants do we want in our settlement or whatever? So it was
none. I cannot stand ants. I would freak out and open the hatch and we would all die.
I'm so glad you told me that. So we're going to put, John, some point we need to get one of those iPhone filters so that when Tarek sees his image on this show, he'll be crawling with ants.
Man, I think I saw them one too many times as a kid.
So. Yeah. Well, and if you ever looked at an ant under a microscope, you'll never touch one again. But it's just it's really worthwhile. And now there's a group out there with a simulation called SAM. They just took a very small part of the larger biosphere setup and welded a submarine hatch to it as an airlock. Oh, wow. And they're now doing much smaller simulations. And of course, the Analog Astronaut Conference is hosted out there.
Enough yeah, Chelsea Goad, who used to she's at JPL now, but she used to be at space.com. She did a mission there, I think, at Biosphere 2.
At SAM. So.
Or she went to the conference there at Biosphere too.
Oh, okay. Because it's only a couple years old. Yeah. But if it was fairly recent, yeah. And they had Martine Rothblatt, who I've talked about before, who runs a contest for the National Space Society and is a very engaged person in terms of future space settlement and so forth, sponsored putting an AI, a talking AI head basically out there that they integrated into their simulation. So that was pretty cool. Okay. Last thing, very small. Well,
and if people want to know more about Biosphere 2, there is a whole 2020 documentary called Spaceship Earth. It is worth watching. It's quite good.
So. Yeah. And a couple of books on it. I think Jane Poynter actually wrote one.
Yeah.
Talking about the details and the challenges of it. And I'm glad I wasn't locked in there for months at a time. All right. Bonus round. Tired World in Huntsville, Alabama. So down the road from the Space and Rocket Center is a shop called Used Tire World. And as you might expect, they sell used car tires. And there's a big kind of a gallows looking metal frame out front. And hanging from it is a 2/3 scale model of the very first iteration of the lunar module.
I could have swore we've talked about this before.
We did, but I just couldn't resist again. So this poor thing, if you're watching the video stream, it's got a happy face pointed on the hatch. It's got all kinds of wonky NASA logos spray painted on it. It's got five landing legs and the upper stage is round. So, you know, it's the older design. So I got together with a group of people from a space group, not the NSS, and said, let's try and get this thing into a museum because there's nothing else like it out there. Everything else was
it's got a big tire on top.
It's got I think that is a tire on top. And this is not where it should be. So we contacted the owners. They didn't want to talk about it. We contacted somebody else through back channels and they got very defensive and said, well, we found it sitting outside of Huntsville and nobody wanted it. So they grabbed it. And I'm pretty sure that wasn't sitting outside of Huntsville. I'm pretty sure it was sitting inside. So I don't know if it was an inside job. It was not apparently legitimate surplus, which is upsetting.
I was going to say, like when we had Robert Perlman of CollectSpace on the channel, he said that they threw out a lot of the stuff. And as soon as they put it in the junkyard, it was like fair game. You can go pull it out of the yard and take it all home. So,
well, I suppose it's possible that they were telling it straight, but it sure felt fishy when I was hearing it. And you know, we were raising money to try and buy this thing from them, but we just could not arrive at a price. They wouldn't even talk about a number. So there it sits, rusting away outside of Tire World. And Huntsville is humid. It's a subtropical environment, and that thing is not going to last forever, but there it is. So, hey, listeners, if anybody's got a spare couple million in your pocket, give me a call, and we'll rescue this thing.
Because a couple of million dollars for that? Really?
Well, think of what stuff goes for at auction, like an astronaut glove.
But that an astronaut glove at auction has provenance, you know, and documentation, not outside.
No, but this was built by Grumman as they were struggling to work through this titanic exercise of building the first few spacecraft. Right. I think that's much cooler than a glove flown or not. And are you listening to me? Okay. Sorry, I get carried away. All right, everybody. I want to thank you for joining us today for episode 106 of This Week in Space, the Space Potpourri Edition. Don't forget to check out, of course, the finest space site on the web, space.com, overseen by our very own Tarek Malik.
Yay!
Their website's in the name. And the National Space Society, of which I am an integral part, at nss.org. They are both good places to satisfy your space flight lust. Cravings.
Whoa.
And,
whoa.
Yeah. Whoa. Yeah.
PG. PG-13.
Tarek, where can we find you gaming away the best years of your life?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at TarekJMalik.com, at space.com. As always, too, this weekend, I'm probably just going to sleep the whole time after like the excitement of the solar eclipse and the driving and everything. Although I am very much looking forward to meeting actually some of my colleagues from the UK that I've not met ever. We're going to go out to dinner because a lot of them were here in the States for the solar eclipse. And before they go back to the UK, we're all going to have dinner at the Galaxy Diner in New York. Very appropriately named. So
I guess my invitation got lost in the mail yet again.
You are always, it's standing. It's always open.
So, okay. Thank you. Just to remind you, don't talk too effusively about USC because you're talking to people that, you know, they have Oxford and Cambridge. Okay. Yeah. So
I noticed, by the way, that I was at the SUNY Potsdam at the university in this village town, and I was wearing all of my USC gear all over the place. God. And I started thinking maybe I shouldn't have brought all this stuff to amplify
security. All right. New episodes of this podcast publish every Friday in your favorite podcatcher. So please make sure to subscribe, tell your friends, give us reviews. We'll take whatever you want, but make sure it's got five digits, whatever it is. You can also head to our website at twit.tv/twists. And remember to drop us a line at twit. Just not doing this well. twist@twit.tv. I'm doing it out of order. That's why. That's twist@twit.tv. We welcome your comments, suggestions, and ideas. And as you can tell, because I started reading listener emails, we will acknowledge you on the air when appropriate. And of course, your jokes. We love getting your comments, suggestions, and jokes. And we answer all our email. Well, I answer all our email because
of Rod does. He does. It's true.
Don't forget, you can get all the great programming with video streams included on the Twit Network ad-free on Club Twit, which you should join because it's only $7 a month. And all the secret backstage stuff we do before the show, well, some of it anyway, the stuff that's PG, is put on there. And it's just $7 a month. And really, honestly, Tarek, what can you buy for $7 a month anymore? I ask you.
Half a mochaccino, maybe? Something like that?
Yeah, yeah. or half a Netflix.
A bag of peanuts on the plane?
And we're way better than Netflix. So you've heard Leo talking about the tough times facing podcasters. Please stand up and be counted. Support us and make us your new NPR. And you can follow the Twit Tech Podcast Network at Twit on Twitter and on Facebook and on twit.tv. and Instagram. Thank you, and we will see you next week. So long.